Digital 410 Productions proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Dodd Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Henry Sledge.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II podcast. And we are back again for another Monday. I was about to say Tuesday, but a Monday, and it's just me and our faithful friend, Henry Sledge. Jeff Copsetta is not with us tonight. And so, you know, Henry, I had a thought. And, you know, the last time Jeff wasn't here, we went on and had a John Bazalone expert on because, well, that's Jeff's favorite thing. And I thought since Jeff wasn't here tonight that you and I could do a good 45 minutes on the joys of model building so that when Jeff comes back next week and wants to talk about his love for the hobby of model building, we can say, sorry, Jeff.
We did it last week. We already covered that, man. We're moving on.
Yeah, we got to keep it fresh, got to keep it moving. So sit down, relax, grab your bourbon, grab your model glue, and let's get going with the joys of World War II model building.
I used to build World War II models, and I kind of like to get back into it. But
we'll definitely save that for next week.
We know we want to do that one with Jeff, because he's certainly done a lot more of that than I have.
Now, one of the things that was probably more popular when you were a kid and myself as a kid in the late 70s and 80s were the model rockets. Not World War II.
I did model rockets, yeah. The Estes.
Yeah, those are the ones you would launch. They're two-phase rockets. You launch them up. They would pop off and the parachute down, and they would make huge ones.
Yeah,
that would damn near that would damn near go into orbit. And I remember I knew one guy actually had a rudimentary tracking device for him because those expensive ones, they would go far, and then they would just go travel miles, and you could potentially be out hundreds of dollars on those things, not to mention hours.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for the casual listeners at home saying, "What's this have to do with World War II?" It wasn't until I got into World War II and reenacting that I realized that those are basically stripped down bazooka rockets.
I did not know that. That's pretty interesting.
Well,
but I remember those little engines you put in them and you lit them. And my brother and all his friends were really into that. And he got me a rocket, and which was a cool thing for an older brother to do for his kid brother. And I remember we went out, we launched it and went up, and we never saw it again.
Well, for those of you who've never launched these rockets, basically they're just a cardboard tube with some, not bamboo. What's that real cheap wood?
Balsa wood.
Yeah, balsa wood fins, plastic tube, and a parachute. And you would slide this little rocket engine in it, and then basically you would put a little V-prong piece of aluminum in it, or almost like a matchstick, right? You'd put it up there, but it was made out of aluminum. You would connect two alligator clips, and it ran 100 yards to a push button that had a 9-volt battery in it. Well, when you're watching those World War II movies and you see the bazooka man sitting there, just think of Band of Brothers, and they're putting the rocket in there, and he's back there fiddling. He said, "You're going to get me killed." Well, what he's doing is hooking up two alligator clips because inside the bazooka is a trigger with a 9-volt battery.
Yeah.
So I don't know this for fact, but I would assume we all know that after the war, you had all these companies manufacturing this stuff. And they either had to re-gear or manufacture something else, or they had to figure out a way to make a civilian equivalent. So my hypothesis is, and I'm sure I'm got to be similarly close, is they made smaller versions of the rockets that they put in the back of those bazookas. And that's what, I mean, it has to be the same. Because once again, you put one of those two-phase rockets, those engines in one of those cardboard tubes, those things would easily fly up 2 miles.
Oh, yeah.
They had some force behind them. So it would only, I mean... You take that same model rocket, you put in a PVC pipe, don't try this at home, and you aim it at something. If it has the right fins and the right balance, I'm sure it'd fly just as far as a damn bazooka.
Oh, yeah. Not that we're advocating any type of homemade explosive device.
No, right? not at all. I mean, this isn't the 80s.
Are we
the
still 90s. In Facebook jail?
Yes and no. We're streaming. We always stream to YouTube, and I post YouTube on Facebook. We are out of Facebook jail as far as them no longer bearing our post. For some reason, not to get too technical, but we restream through a program called Restream.io. And that website allows me to put in accounts for Twitch, YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. But for Facebook, for some reason, they will only allow me to either add my personal account or my group page, whatsinyourhead.com. if I go in there and delete what's in your head and try to add what's the scuttlebutt or fail to fail, they don't even show up as options. So I don't even have the ability to stream directly to the What's the Scuttlebutt Facebook page through our service. Why? I don't know. I've contacted them. They don't have an answer. I've thought about actually deleting What's in Your Head and trying to stream to my D-Train page, because that page actually technically has enough followers to qualify us for monetization. Whether it would happen or not, I don't know. But anyhow, that's neither here nor there. We are on Twitch, we are on Twitter, and we are on YouTube. And I want to thank the new YouTube followers. And we're getting subscriptions up. And for those of you guys who followed us on Patreon. And I also want to thank you guys so much. Last week, we kind of did a dual-part episode, which we haven't done in a long time. We had a guest on, and then we did a replay of the Byron Vineyard interview. And looking at the numbers, just about every one of you who downloaded part one stuck around and downloaded and listened to part two. The numbers were damn near exactly.
Great.
So thank you guys
that.
For not only listening to the first half with Woodage and that great interview, but sticking around and listening to that replay we did with Byron Vineyard, who was.
I meant to tell you about that, Don. Of course, we had Paul and we were busy with him, but when I first heard about What's the Scuttlebutt before you guys had me on and then invited me to be a part of this, that show with Vineyard was one of the ones I listened to.
Yeah.
Because, I was just scrolling through your website, just, here's one where they talk about, I want to hear that. And the one with him just happened to be one that I listened to.
Fantastic. So,
to hear that he passed away. But
it's kind of weird because I've been doing not only this, but I do so many podcasts that I oftentimes forget who we've had on and, interviews I've done. So when I saw the original post, I texted Jeff, I was like, didn't we have him on the show? And he's like, absolutely. And so I went back and so it's always kind of fun for me to go back and re-listen to it because it refreshes my memory and I get to, and once there's that much space between me and the interview, it's almost like I'm listening to it as a listener, not as the person who actually did the interview. And so it's kind of new and fresh to me. And so that was, I always enjoy going back and doing those as well. I was hoping Jeff was going to be on here tonight. I watched two movies this weekend. Well, a movie and a third, as I explained to you in a text message. You're like, how do you watch a third of a movie? But
I actually thought that was one of your talk text errors when I saw that.
No.
So I wasn't even going to ask you what it meant. It's just, I'm like, okay, Don's talk texting and we'll figure it out later.
Before I get into this, I want to verify something. Now, we all know from Memphis Belle and, those type of movies that at least in those bombers, the microphone system was the one around the neck, right? That was the only aviation communication device of the time. Am I correct on that or no?
I know the fighter pilots in the Pacific all use throat mics.
What about in European theater? I believe that's the only technology available, right?
Oh man, somebody out there, this is a really esoteric question. Well, is this like
it's leading into something, which is why I only watched one third of a movie.
Gotcha.
All know from watching Iron Eagle and the late 80s movies that around the time of the F-16 and the F-14, they moved the microphone to the oxygen mask, right? Which made sense that when they have it. And so when you watch Iron Eagle in his movies and they're talking, they kind of hold their oxygen mask close to their mouth. So you can still see their pretty face on camera, but they're simulating the communication. We did not have that technology in World War II, correct? There was no aviation microphone built into the oxygen mask.
I believe that's correct.
Okay.
I just watched Midway again last night. And
I was hoping Jeff would be on here because you and him are both more into aviation than I am. Have you seen Red Wings?
I have not.
Me neither. And so I was on Amazon this weekend and I was in my bedroom looking for something to watch and Red Wings came on. I was like, okay, well, the preview is up there. I was like, well, I know that's an interesting story, aviation. I need to kind of update my views on it, and I watch a lot of movies about a lot of things, but I don't watch a whole hell of a lot of aviation based movies. And month that it is, great, let's watch this. So I turn on Red Wings, and I don't know why, the dumbest thing ever. The first thing that bumped me was the font they used in all the actors' name, bright red, but anyhow, it's Red Wings, fine, whatever. opening scene, they got the bee.
Wait, are you talking about Red Tails?
Red Tails. I'm sorry, not Red Wing. Red Tails. Have you seen that one?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so Red Tails. It's about the Tuskegee Airmen. So I was excited. Great actors. Perfect time of the year to watch it. It's up on Amazon. Opening scene, you got your B-27s, the Flying Fortresses flying around.
17s.
B-17s, once again, I'm not in the aviation stuff. I should know at least that part from Airborne. But anyhow, the B-17s are flying around, and they're getting ready to go on their bombing runs. No, it's a B-17 bombers. They're about to go on their bombing runs, and you have your the escorts up there. I don't think, what, the Mustangs over in Europe?
Well, yeah, but I mean, starting out, I think
the P-38s
might have been flying
P-40s. Okay, so you got the P-40s up there. Once, this is why I'm trying to watch a movie. I'm trying to get up to speed with the aviation stuff. I'm admittedly dumb and ignorant on it. I have my strong points. That's why I have other people.
I've never said that.
But I'll say it. So I'm ignorant on the subject of aviation, but that's why we have Jeff and Henry on here. You know, between the three of us, we cover a lot of ground.
There you go.
And we've never said we're experts in any certain topic. So I'm watching this. And the P-38 squadron captain's like, hey, there's Germans. Let's go get them. And they take off, leaving everybody else unprotected. And then they cut to the inside scene. And, of course, the captain of one of the B-17s is like, oh, there they go, the glory hounds, leaving us unprotected. And then here come the Germans and just annihilate the American bomber ships. Okay, cool. So then they cut to, and at that point, I was like, okay, I see the groundwork delaying here, but I'm going to stick with it. I'm going to hold tight. And then they cut to, like, the Tuskegee Airmen doing practice runs before they actually get to go to combat, right? I think they were over in North Africa or maybe Italy, and their jobs is doing, like, strafing runs of railroad tracks and just targets of opportunity. They weren't actually engaging.
Right.
But every time they showed these guys communicating, because, once again, these are actors, they don't want to have their oxygen mask on, they were doing the 1980 Iron Eagle, grabbing their oxygen mask and talking into them as if that was the microphone system.
Well, that's a good observation.
But I
don't think they had oxygen mask mics until later, but I could be wrong.
I'm thinking maybe the Korean War when they started bringing the jets in. But good anyhow, question. I'm watching it and I'm hurting. And then they cut to the scene where they're kind of introducing the characters, and just to me, it wasn't a World War II movie honoring Tuskegee Airmen. It was an action movie that took place in World War II, and they're using the name of the. And I probably turned it off after 15 minutes. I just couldn't. I was like, I can't do this, which bothered me. I really wanted to watch this movie, but the dialogue was horrible. The fact that they're talking in the mask, and they were using like more modern music, and just. And I realized, oh, this isn't a World War II movie. This is a action movie that takes place in World War II. And I lost interest. And I went the completely opposite way. I know it's a World War II podcast, but we talk about military history. How are you familiar with the 1999 movie, The Trench?
Actually, I'm not.
The Trench is a 1999 British war film directed by William Boyd and starring Paul Nicholas and Daniel Craig. You know who he is. He played 007 a few years back.
Mm-hmm.
Are you also familiar with Peaky Blinders?
No.
Peaky Blinders is a British TV show. It's post-World War I, after all the guys come home from war. It's a English, kind of Irish, more English mob family. The wives and the women have been running things while the boys were off fighting World War I, and now they come back and they're taking everything over. But anyhow, the reason I bring it up is the lead actor is his name in the show is Tommy, and he's the head of the Peaky Blinders, and he's played by a gentleman named Cillian Murphy, C-I-L-L-I-A-N, Cillian Murphy or Killian Murphy. Now you know him as the pilot who had the nervous breakdown in the boat in Dunkirk.
Okay.
The pilot who turned the boat around. We're not going. That is the lead character of Tommy on Peaky Blinders. Well, this movie came out in 1999, and that must have been one of his first films. He was clearly like 17 years old in it. But anyhow, this is a World War I movie. The film paints a picture of soldiers' emotional experiences in the confines of the trenches and experiencing running the gamut from boredom to fear, panic, and restlessness. Basically 3 days up to the kickoff of Psalms attack in World War One. Is it Psalms?
S-O-M-M-E-S.
Yes, that's the one where 60,000 right. British soldiers died in one day. And so I'm, okay, World War One movie. It's going back to this film, the 1999. It's pretty interesting. And so for you guys watching at home, I'm going to quickly play the trailer for this, and you guys can see it. Let me just make sure that you guys can see it. Sadly, the way we're doing this, Henry won't be able to see it, but he will be able to hear it. And I'll just kind of read some of the things. A lot of times these trailers, they don't have audible but visual stuff. So here is the trailer for the 1999 movie, The Trench.
Wakey, wakey, come on there, come on! Attention!
I want to assure you, men,
when you set off over the top, you'll be able to slow palms, light your pipes, and march all the way to Bapaume before you meet a single live German.
The Battle of the Somme, June 1916. 8 feet wide.
First platoon to kick it into German lines gets a barrel of beer.
Hey, bully! That bottle of beer's as good as one pound.
600 miles long, the trench. Man-made. God-forsaken.
So what's it like?
You don't have time to be fighting for long. When you go over the top, you're in another world.
He was stupid because he didn't listen to me.
They're just sitting there, waiting for us.
7:30.
But that's broad daylight.
Max! Starring Daniel Craig.
Get through. Don't worry, son.
Cillian Murphy.
Do you know, Sarge?
We wait.
Ben Norshar, Danny Dreyer. The Trench. Now, this is a very good movie. Now, being the fact that I'm a World War II historian and not a World War I historian, I didn't fall for the problems that we face where you start nitpicking uniforms and all that problems. And so that was good for me. But one of the things I realized about this movie being shot in 1999... it probably would not do well today because it is a slow burn. Mm-hmm. You know, you're as old as I am. We remember things like the Alien, where the Alien, you couldn't see it for the first 20 minutes of the movie.
Right.
Nowadays, with all these new action, all these new movies, it's as soon as the credits start rolling, the action, it's nonstop action for 2 hours.
Right. It's in your face with an explosion or something.
But this movie being one filmed in the 90s, and we're all about slow burn, and the fact that they're trying to build the anticipation and show you the hurry up and wait aspect of the military. And here it is 2 days before. And these guys are sleeping in this 8 foot wide trench that has 15 foot walls or 12 foot walls. They actually made a comment, you know, this trench dug so deep because anytime they see our heads, snipers will hit us. Mm-hmm. And they just show the monotony, the boredom, the hardship of, and there's a few little action scenes from mortar strikes and snipers, but basically there's much like we're going to get into here momentarily, Dunkirk, there's very little action for this probably an hour and a half long movie until they go mm-hmm. up and over at the end. But it's for World War One movie, it's on Amazon Prime. It's, if you have Amazon, it's streaming free. Definitely check it out. You know, if you like 1916, which was a great flick, this kind of goes into it. It's always fun to see actors now who are real big into things back when they're getting their start. But it was a pretty good little flick. And when they went up and over at the end. Now, I don't know if, not to spoiler alert, but we know what happens at that battle. But when they went up and over at the end, what struck me as odd, I don't know if it was artistic licensing on the behalf of the director because it was the final scene. They went up and over, but it wasn't charge. They weren't hauling mm-hmm. ass and running. It reminded me more of a slow Revolutionary War, shoulder to shoulder, just walk across the battlefield with bayonets drawn. And now, if that is the way that they fought World War One, no blank that they lost 60,000 cats that mm-hmm. day, because once again, they weren't running, they weren't zigzagging, they weren't run, drop, fire. It was just a slow walk with your bayonets just walking.
Well, I've always heard, and now World War One is not my thing at all, but I've always heard that they had those, they still had somewhat to a degree, the Napoleonic tactics of what you just described.
Yeah.
Mixed with the horrific modernity of a machine gun.
Yeah. They got the Lewis guns.
It's, you know, 60,000 guys dying a day.
Yeah.
And then they, you know, quickly adapt. But I am no expert on World War One, but I have kind of always heard that.
Yeah, it was, and it made for a great final scene, because when you're walking that slow, they got real artsy with it. And like when somebody got hit, they paused on them for a second and kind of showed the tragedy of it. There is one scene that was really pretty gruesome where a couple of guys got hit by an artillery strike, and it wasn't one of those, you know, they show them and it was boom, they're gone. It was, you heard the sound, you heard this, you know, and then guys walking down the trench, he turns a corner and there's just pieces of them laying there, and it was a slow pan. And so it was definitely a gritty, dirty movie. But if you guys are into World War One stuff, or you're looking for something to change up your repertoire a little bit, look at us using fancy words, repertoire. Definitely go to Amazon and check out The Trench. Now we're going to reactivate this, and we're going to play the trailer of Dunkirk, because Henry has some thoughts on this. And we'll play the trailer and then we will go. And I don't know, maybe this feature will work pretty well on YouTube and we can use it more in the future. So here we go.
The enemy tanks have stopped.
Why?
Why waste precious tanks when they can pick us off from the air like fish in a barrel?
There are 400,000 men on this beach.
Soldier walking into the waves because he's so desperate. It's almost like he thinks he's going to swim back to England.
He's coming back round.
He's coming back round!
This summer.
Where are we going?
Dunkirk.
There's no hiding from this, son. We have a job to do.
If we go there, we'll die.
Hope is a weapon. Survival is victory.
You see it from here.
What?
Home.
Dunkirk. Now, this is one of those movies that I'm glad I practice a lesson that I learned from growing up in Ohio and going to Cedar Point or Kentucky when the latest, or Kings Island down in Cincinnati, when the latest, greatest roller coaster comes out. And everybody's talking about how great, ooh, the Manis is awesome. The Raptor's fantastic. You hear all this hype, you hear all this build up, and then you stand in line, you're all nervous, and you ride it. I'm like, well, that was cool, but I don't know what all the hype was about. And so that's a lesson I've taken in life, where I don't allow myself to fall into hype for anything. I wait until people talk about things. I don't go check out trailers. I don't go look at fan sites to see the early write-ups on stuff. The argument can be made that maybe I'm missing out on life, but I find if I don't fall into the hoopla and this pre-release circus of things, I go in with a level, steady expectation.
And no preconceived notions.
And I tend to be more excited about things. But when it comes out with like Dunkirk and all the publicity they put into it and all that, I'll save my thoughts. What were yours? You just recently watched it, so it's fresh in your head.
Yeah, watched it on Netflix. I had heard that it was really well received. I mean, it looked like it got rave reviews. I got to be honest, man, I was kind of underwhelmed. So I watched it again. I liked it a little better the second time. You know, as you said earlier, Jeff and I are both really big aviation guys. So the scenes with the Spitfires taking on the 109s.
Tom Hardy.
I think they took on a Heinkel 111 too. You know, I was really watching those with a lot of interest. One thing that, did you ever hear of a movie? It was actually a Czechoslovakian movie called The Dark Blue World.
No.
Came out back in the early 2000s. It was about a couple of Polish guys who went and fought in the Battle of Britain, as we know a lot of them did. I thought the aerial scenes in that movie were far better than Dunkirk. To me,
now was that movie not to cut you off, but was that movie, was that done with real planes or CGI? Oh, I'm sure it wasn't CGI if it's as old as you state it was.
I don't think it was CGI. I think it was real planes.
Do you think on that note that you would think with CGI your options are limitless? As long as you can draw a plane on a computer, you have options. But I think maybe what tends to happen is, since you're relying on people with computer skills and you're not actually flying real planes, you don't get the majesty of what the planes can physically do, and you don't have the experts on site, i.e. the pilots, saying, here's what we can do, here's a scene we can create. And maybe that's why when you have, think of it like the old 70s and 80 car chase scenes in movies, like just, you know, Bullet and all those were just a long drawn-out car chase scenes. And then nowadays, with the CGI version of the car chase scene, it's just missing something. Maybe it's the authenticity, I don't know, but something's clearly missing.
Well, I just felt like the aerial combat scenes were just kind of bland to me. I mean, when I see an aerial combat scene, you know, those airplanes, and Damon Stout, the guy that I'm collaborating with on this film about VMF 114, the Marine Fighter Squadron at Peleliu, we've had this conversation because there are going to be some aerial sequences in that dock that we're doing. Those airplanes were living, breathing things. They're going through turbulence. They're squeaking. They're rattling. The guys are bouncing up and down in their seats. There's turbulence. You know, and especially if there's shell bursts nearby. They're not just...
It's more like, going back to the roller coaster analogy, it's more like the old school roller coasters on the tracks versus the one on the rails. The ones on the rails are nice and smooth, but the ones on the track are jerky. They're bad on your lower back, and they shake. Yes. And that's what the airplanes are like.
They're bouncing up and down in their seats. You know, they're straining against their straps. They're catching shell bursts. Those planes, they're getting the hell beat out of them every day just from the maintenance standpoint. So I don't know. The aerial combat, and maybe people out there who fly warbirds every day are saying, oh, no, it's the most incredible thing they've ever done. And then I guess I just speak under correction. But in my opinion, the aerial scenes just seem really bland. Another thing, when they would fire their guns, you hardly saw any tracers.
Yeah.
Maybe they didn't have tracers that early, but generally you would see a little bit more, you know, like you can see where your rounds are going, but it just seemed like there wasn't a lot there. So, I had the same thought. It's like the planes were on rails.
Problem I had with the movie, and I'll have to go back and watch it a second time. I was a big movie buff back in the 90s, and I talked about this on my other podcast the other day. You know, when I was between the ages of 18 and 25, I was struggling. I couldn't afford cable, so I'd go to the video stores, and I'd buy the third off tapes for $3, and we'd go home. I had a whole VHS library of every Kevin Smith movie, Lock, Stock, you know, Guy Ritchie movies, all these movies, Pulp Fiction, all the Quentin Tarantino stuff. And then when I got in my mid-20s and all that, same things, just instead of buying VHS tapes, we'd gotten by DVDs at Blockbuster and then at Target, whatever. And if I open this closet, my podcast studio, I got about 200 DVD movies. Wow. And the last movies I've gotten in the last probably 12 years were gifts, which was, I got the box set of The Pacific for Christmas. I got Band of Brothers, and I got a few World War II movies that are given me here and there. And the reason I say all that is I'm into movies. I'm into stylization. Going back to Quentin Tarantino, if you don't think Quentin Tarantino changed the way movies were made, you weren't alive when Pulp Fiction came out. Pulp Fiction was the first mainstream movie that did the time jump. The sequences where things, the movie actually, the beginning of the movie is actually near the end of the movie.
And it's a non-linear.
It's a non-linear, but by the time it gets to the end of the physical movie, all the pieces fall in place, and Quentin Tarantino does it excellently, and it all falls in place. It's logical. It's conducive. And you're like, oh, okay. You walk away, and you get it. Mm-hmm. Problem I had with Dunkirk is they tried to do the Pulp Fiction-style time jump, and it was hard to follow. It's like one minute he's flying, and it's light out. Next minute, it's super dark. But then later, oh, wait a minute, I think he was flying through a burning oil field. It's like,
right.
To me, the time jump and how they tried to do the Pulp Fiction, Quentin Tarantino style, non-linear, hope all the pieces fall in, makes sense at the ending, that didn't make sense.
Well, on that exact note, so yeah, you could tell, like, the guy was supposed to be getting close to being out of fuel.
Yeah.
And Spitfires had notoriously short duration anyway, which was a problem in the Battle of Britain because they only had so much time once they got over the channel. But he's obviously running short on gas. He may even have a leak too, if I remember right. I can't remember for sure, but toward the end of the movie, and this is when it really, like you're talking about, but it's really getting artistic. He runs out of gas. He's gliding. It seemed like he's gliding forever. I'm like, man, I didn't know a warbird could glide that far. And then I realized the second time, okay,
they're slowing time down.
Yeah, so we're getting kind of poetic here. And then, like, it was late afternoon, and by the time he's done gliding, it's like night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then doesn't he shoot a flare into a spit to blow it up so the Germans don't get it? And he's standing there, you know, glowing, you know, his face is glowing in the flames, and it's very dramatic. I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm panning the movie at all, because I'm not saying it wasn't a good movie. I just,
there was some poor execution in it.
There was a lot of stuff I just had trouble following. Like when the guys got in the boat right mm-hmm. there, you know, and it's like they're down in the hole.
They're trying to stop the leak or get the water out. They're trying to, I can't remember exactly, but they're trying to get the thing. Oh no, they're hiding in the hole waiting for high tide to come in, because if they wait outside, they're at risk of being shot by snipers.
And so, okay, right. All right. And then they hear activity outside, and I'm like, why doesn't somebody peek up above a hatch and just see what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. That was a little hard to follow.
And going back to the poorly executable of the time jump, as we said earlier, and as you heard in the preview, the guy who plays in Peaky Blinders, he gets shot down. The armada of voluntary boat, one of them finds him. It wasn't until it was explained to me later that he got shot down during that dogfight. He was like Tom Hardy's wingman. But the whole time jump thing, I thought that guy just was from a different squadron, had nothing to do with that battle, because once again, the execution of the time jump was so done so poorly, because they find him at the beginning of the movie. And the visual of the battles happen near the middle or end of the movie. And it just, once again, the time jump was so bad that you had a hard time. Oh, he was one of the people in that squadron, because he had his mask on when they showed him in the squadron. So he didn't realize who it was. And so to me, my biggest down, you know, obviously they can't add more action than actually happened in Dunkirk. So, you know, you had a bunch of guys stuck on the beach. So it's not like they're going to have a bunch of action scenes.
Well,
But go ahead.
Well, the older gentleman in the boat, you know, when they picked him up.
Yeah.
The old guy who had the boat and his son.
Which was all true. You can go on Google and find the images of him.
Sure. So, but then there was another kid who jumped on with them at the dock before they left out.
Mm-hmm.
At first, I thought both those young guys were his. Well, it's the guy who ends up, the pilot pushes him down the stairs, and the guy ends up getting head injured.
He was like a school kid or a neighbor. Yeah.
I thought, exactly. But I thought he was like the other young guy's brother.
Yeah.
In other words, they were both like the old guy was their dad. I didn't realize till the second time, and it still wasn't clear. I'm like, wait, okay. Because when the kid died, they were just going like, oh, he's dead. Okay.
Yeah.
That's awful, Nate.
That's Bobby that's Bobby from down the street. We don't really care.
Like, they're not very upset when his own son just got killed. But then I realized, well, that's not his son. But so that, I had to watch it the second time to get that. But
and plus, plus you got to do the mental gymnastics that, oh yeah, the kid was a little more shocked because he had never seen death, but his dad was a World War I veteran. So he already was kind of hardened and compartmentalized. This isn't the first time he had seen a 17-year-old kid die.